Chapter 2. The French ships were permitted to come on shore and see the tomb of Napoleon. Bertrand, Gergaud, Las Cases wandered about the island and revisited the spots to which they had been partial in the lifetime of the emperor. The 15th October was fixed on for the day of the exhumation. That day 25 years, the Emperor Napoleon first set his foot upon the island. On the day previous all things had been made ready. The grand coffins and ornaments brought from France, and the articles necessary for the operation were carried to the valley of the tomb. The operations commenced at midnight. The well-known friends of Napoleon before named, and some other attendants of his, the chaplain and his acolytes, the doctor of the El Paul, the captains of the French ships, and Captain Alexander of the Engineers, the English commissioner, attended the disinterment. His Royal Highness Prince de Joinville could not be present because the workmen were under English command. The men worked for 9 hours incessantly. When at length the earth was entirely removed from the vault, all the horizontal strata of masonry demolished, and the large slab which covered the place where the stone sarcophagus lay, removed by a crane. This outer coffin of stone was perfect, and could scarcely be said to be damp. As soon as the Abbé Coquereau had recited the prayers, the coffin was removed with the greatest care, and carried by the engineer soldiers, bareheaded, into a tent that had been prepared for the purpose. After the religious ceremonies, the inner coffins were opened. The outermost coffin was slightly injured. Then came one of lead, which was in good condition, and enclosed two others, one of tin and one of wood. The last coffin was lined inside with white satin, which, having become detached by the effect of time, had fallen upon the body, and enveloped it like a winding sheet, and had become slightly attached to it. It is difficult to describe with what anxiety and emotion those who were present waited for the moment which was to expose to them all that death had left of Napoleon. Notwithstanding the singular state of preservation of the tomb and coffins, we could scarcely hope to find anything but some misshapen remains of the least perishable part of the costume to evidence the identity of the body. But when Dr. Gillard raised the sheet of satin, an indescribable feeling of surprise and affection was expressed by the spectators, many of whom burst into tears. The emperor was himself before their eyes. The features of the face, though changed, were perfectly recognized. The hands extremely beautiful. His well-known costume had suffered but little, and the colors were easily distinguished. The attitude itself was full of ease, and but for the fragments of the satin lining which covered, as with a fine gauze, several parts of the uniform, we might have believed we still saw Napoleon before us lying on his bed of state. General Bertrand and M. Marcand, who were both present at the interment, quickly pointed out the different articles which each had deposited in the coffin, and remained in the precise position in which they had previously described them to be. The two inner coffins were carefully closed again. The old leaden coffin was strongly blocked up with wedges of wood, and both were once more soldered up with the most minute precautions, under the direction of Dr. Gillard. These different operations being terminated, the ebony sarcophagus was closed as well as its oak case. On delivering the key of the ebony sarcophagus to Count de Chabot, the king's commissioner, Captain Alexander declared to him, in the name of the governor, that this coffin, containing the mortal remains of the Emperor Napoleon, was considered as at the disposal of the French government from that day, and from the moment at which it should arrive at the place of embarkation, towards which it was about to be sent under the orders of General Middlemore. The king's commissioner replied that he was charged by his government, and in its name, to accept the coffin from the hands of the British authorities, and that he and the other persons composing the French mission were ready to follow it to Jamestown, where the Prince de Joinville, superior commandant of the expedition, would be ready to receive it and conduct it on board his frigate. A car drawn by 4 horses, decked with funereal emblems, had been prepared before the arrival of the expedition, to receive the coffin, as well as a pall, and all the other suitable trappings of mourning. When the sarcophagus was placed on the car, the whole was covered with a magnificent imperial mantle brought from Paris, the four corners of which were borne by Generals Bertrand and Gergaud, Baron Las Cases and M. Marcand. At 3:30 the funeral car began to move, preceded by a chorister bearing the cross, and by the Abbé Coquereau. M. de Chabot acted as chief mourner. All the authorities of the island, all the principal inhabitants, and the whole of the garrison, followed in procession from the tomb to the quay. But with the exception of the artillerymen necessary to lead the horses, and occasionally support the car, when descending some steep parts of the way, the places nearest the coffin were reserved for the French mission. General Middlemore, although in a weak state of health, persisted in following the whole way on foot, together with General Churchill, chief of the staff in India, who had arrived only 2 days before from Bombay. The immense weight of the coffins, and the unevenness of the road, rendered the utmost carefulness necessary throughout the whole distance. Colonel Trelawney commanded in person the small detachment of artillerymen who conducted the car, and, thanks to his great care, not the slightest accident took place. From the moment of departure to the arrival at the quay, the cannons of the forts and the Belle Powell fired minute guns. After an hour's march the rain ceased for the first time since the commencement of the operations, and on arriving in sight of the town we found a brilliant sky and beautiful weather. From the morning the three French vessels of war had assumed the usual signs of deep mourning. Their yards crossed and their flags lowered. Two French merchantmen, Bonhomie and Indian, apostrophe which had been in the roads for 2 days, had put themselves under the prince's orders, and followed during the ceremony all the maneuvers of the Belle Powell. Apostrophe the forts of the town, and the houses of the consuls, had also their flags half-mast high. On arriving at the entrance of the town, the troops of the garrison and the militia formed in two lines as far as the extremity of the quay. According to the order for mourning prescribed for the English army, the men had their arms reversed, and the officers had crape on their arms, with their swords reversed. All the inhabitants had been kept away from the line of march, but they lined the terraces, commanding the town, and the streets were occupied only by the troops, the 91st Regiment being on the right, and the militia on the left. The cortege advanced slowly between two ranks of soldiers to the sound of a funeral march, while the cannons of the forts were fired, as well as those of the Belle Powell and the Dolphin. Apostrophe the echoes being repeated 1,000 times by the rocks above Jamestown. After 2 hours' march the cortege stopped at the end of the quay, where the Prince de Joinville had stationed himself at the head of the officers of the three French ships of war. The greatest official honors had been rendered by the English authorities to the memory of the Emperor. The most striking testimonials of respect had marked the adieu given by St. Helena to his coffin, and from this moment the mortal remains of the Emperor were about to belong to France. When the funeral car stopped, the Prince de Joinville advanced alone, and in presence of all around, who stood with their heads uncovered, received, in a solemn manner, the imperial coffin from the hands of General Middlemore. His Royal Highness then thanked the governor, in the name of France, for all the testimonials of sympathy and respect with which the authorities and inhabitants of St. Helena had surrounded the memorable ceremonial. A cutter had been expressly prepared to receive the coffin. During the embarkation, which the prince directed himself, the bands played funeral airs, and all the boats were stationed round with their oars shipped. The moment the sarcophagus touched the cutter, a magnificent royal flag, which the ladies of Jamestown had embroidered for the occasion, was unfurled, and the Belle Powell immediately squared her masts, and unfurled her colors. All the maneuvers of the frigate were immediately followed by the other vessels. Our mourning had ceased with the exile of Napoleon, and the French naval division dressed itself out in all its festal ornaments, to receive the imperial coffin under the French flag. The sarcophagus was covered in the cutter with the imperial mantle. The Prince de Joinville placed himself at the rudder, Commandant Guyot at the head of the boat, Generals Bertrand and Gergaud, Baron Las Cases, M. Marcand, and the Abcock were all occupied the same places as during the march. Count Chabot and Commandant Hernaux were astern, a little in advance of the Prince. As soon as the cutter had pushed off from the quay, the batteries ashore fired a salute of 21 guns, and our ships returned the salute with all their artillery. Two other salutes were fired during the passage from the quay to the frigate, the cutter advancing very slowly, and surrounded by the other boats. At 6:30 it reached the bell powell, apostrophe all the men being on the yards with their hats in their hands. The Prince had arranged on the deck a chapel, decked with flags and trophies of arms, the altar being placed at the foot of the mizzen mast. The coffin, carried by our sailors, passed between two ranks of officers with drawn swords, and was placed on the quarter deck. The absolution was pronounced by the Abcock Waro the same evening. Next day, at 10:00, a solemn mass was celebrated on the deck, in presence of the officers and part of the crews of the ships. His Royal Highness stood at the foot of the coffin. The cannon of the Favorite and Dorst fired minute guns during this ceremony, which terminated by a solemn absolution, and the Prince de Joinville, the gentlemen of the mission, the officers, and the premier's maters of the ship, sprinkled holy water on the coffin. At 11, all the ceremonies of the church were accomplished, all the honors done to a sovereign had been paid to the mortal remains of Napoleon. The coffin was carefully lowered between decks, and placed in the chapelle ardente which had been prepared at Toulon for its reception. At this moment, the vessels fired a last salute with all their artillery, and the frigate took in her flags, keeping up only her flag at the stern, and the royal standard at the maintopgallant mast. On Sunday, the 18th, at 8 in the morning, the Belle Powell quitted St. Helena with her precious deposit on board. During the whole time that the mission remained at Jamestown, the best understanding never ceased to exist between the population of the island and the French. The Prince de Joinville and his companions met in all quarters, and at all times with the greatest goodwill, and the warmest testimonials of sympathy. The authorities and the inhabitants must have felt, no doubt, great regret at seeing taken away from their island the coffin that had rendered it so celebrated. But they repressed their feelings with a courtesy that does honor to the frankness of their character. 2. On the voyage from St. Helena to Paris. On the 18th October the French frigate quitted the island with its precious burden on board. His Royal Highness the Captain acknowledged cordially the kindness and attention which he and his crew had received from the English authorities and the inhabitants of the island of St. Helena, nay, promised a pension to an old soldier who had been for many years the guardian of the imperial tomb, and went so far as to take into consideration the petition of a certain lodging housekeeper, who prayed for a compensation for the loss which the removal of the emperor's body would occasion to her. And although it was not to be expected that the great French nation should forego its natural desire of recovering the remains of a hero so dear to it for the sake of the individual interest of the landlady in question, it must have been satisfactory to her to find that the peculiarity of her position was so delicately appreciated by the august prince who commanded the expedition, and carried away with him animi dimidium sui the half of the genteel independence which she derived from the situation of her hotel. In a word, politeness and friendship could not be carried farther. The prince's realm and the landlady's were bound together by the closest ties of amity. M. Fiers was minister of France, the great patron of the English alliance. At London M. Gizet was the worthy representative of the French goodwill towards the British people, and the remark frequently made by our orators at public dinners, that France and England, while united, might defy the world, was considered as likely to hold good for many years to come, the Union that is. As for defying the world, that was neither here nor there, Nor did English politicians ever dream of doing any such thing, except perhaps at the 10th glass of port at Riemerson's tavern. Little, however, did Mrs. Corbett, the St. Helena landlady, little did His Royal Highness Prince Ferdinand Philip Marie de Joinville, know what was going on in Europe all this time. When I say in Europe, I mean in Turkey, Syria, and Egypt, how clouds, in fact, were gathering upon what you call the political horizon, and how tempests were rising that were to blow to pieces our Anglo-Gallic temple of friendship. Oh, but it is sad to think that a single wicked old Turk should be the means of setting our two Christian nations by the ears. Yes, my love, this disreputable old man had been for some time past the object of the disinterested attention of the great sovereigns of Europe. The Emperor Nicholas, a moral character, though following the Greek superstition, and adored for his mildness and benevolence of disposition, the Emperor Ferdinand, the King of Prussia, and our own gracious Queen, had taken such just offense at his conduct and disobedience towards a young and interesting sovereign, whose authority he had disregarded, whose fleet he had kidnapped, whose fair provinces he had pounced upon, that they determined to come to the aid of Abdulmejid I, Emperor of the Turks, and bring his rebellious vassal to reason. In this project the French nation was invited to join. But they refused the invitation, saying that it was necessary for the maintenance of the balance of power in Europe that His Highness Mehmed Ali should keep possession of what by hook or by crook he had gotten, and that they would have no hand in injuring him. But why continue this argument, which you have read in the newspapers for many months past? You, my dear, must know as well as I that the balance of power in Europe could not possibly be maintained in any such way, and though, to be sure, for the last 15 years, the progress of the old robber has not made much difference to us in the neighborhood of Russell Square, and the Battle of Nezib did not in the least affect our taxes, our homes, our institutions, or the price of butcher's meat, yet there is no knowing what might have happened had Mehmed Ali been allowed to remain quietly as he was. And the balance of power in Europe might have been the deuce knows where. Here, then, in a nutshell, you have the whole matter in dispute. While Mrs. Corbett and the Prince de Joinville were innocently interchanging compliments at St. Helena, bang! Bang! Commodore Napier was pouring broadsides into Tyre and Sidon. Our gallant navy was storming breaches and routing armies. Colonel Hodges had seized upon the green standard of Ibrahim Pasha, and the powder magazine of St. John of Acre was blown up sky high, with 1,800 Egyptian soldiers in company with it. The French said that Lord Angus had achieved all these successes, and no doubt believed that the poor fellows at Acre were bribed to a man. It must have been particularly unpleasant to a high-minded nation like the French at the very moment when the Egyptian affair and the balance of Europe had been settled in this abrupt way, to find out all of a sudden that the Pasha of Egypt was their dearest friend and ally. They had suffered in the person of their friend, and though, seeing that the dispute was ended and the territory out of his hand, they could not hope to get it back for him, or to aid him in any substantial way, yet Monsieur Thiers determined, just as a mark of politeness to the Pasha, to fight all Europe for maltreating him, all Europe, England included. He was bent on war, and an immense majority of the nation went with him. He called for 1,000,000 of soldiers, and would have had them too, had not the king been against the project, and delayed the completion of it at least for a time. Of these great European disputes, Captain Joinville received a notification while he was at sea on board his frigate, as we find by the official account which has been published of his mission. Some days after quitting St. Helena, says that document, the expedition fell in with a ship coming from Europe, and was thus made acquainted with the warlike rumors then afloat, by which a collision. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.